Welcome to Happily Ever After is just the beginning. Keeping your relationship not just together, but happy, and we mean truly happy, is part art and part science. You've come to the right place. Here's your host, Leslie Dorries.
I've been a couples counselor, marriage counselor, coach. I've worked with couples for over 10 years, and it still amazes me by what people will accept in their relationship and how long they will accept it. The going standard is that it takes an average of 6 years for a couple to be unhappy before they get help. And my question is what else do we wait that long for? If you had a cough or you had a sore leg or you had a leak in your roof, you'd get help before 6 years. And often the seeds for difficulty in a relationship are apparent early on, but somehow we dismiss them. The son of a friend of mine had been with his girlfriend for over 11 years, and they get married, they've had a baby, the baby is less than 6 months old, and they're separated because she's finally gotten upset with the way he communicates. Now, he didn't suddenly start communicating differently after they got married. She knew about it beforehand but never addressed it. Now we got the six-month-old baby smack dab in the middle of it. And it's often said that the first year of marriage is the hardest because getting married doesn't magically solve these issues. But all that said, all does not have to be lost. There is a way to address the challenges and create a great marriage. So I'm joined by couples therapist, Dr. Becca Jorgensen, and she's here to share what you can do to finally heal your relationship and really get that happily ever after that everybody says they want. So Dr. Jorgensen, Becca, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm happy to be here.
I discovered you when I was reading. I read a lot of people's information about how to have a good marriage and preparing for the show, and I came across your post, Protect Your Marriage, Relationship Help. And in this post, you talk about some studies done by Dr. Ted Houston about the importance of the first years of marriage. Can you elaborate a little bit on what Dr. Houston found?
Well, his research is really great, and he looks at the ways that couples get together and that early, actually premarital research, and how people are responsive to each other and how that changes sometimes after we get married. And so there's some early warning signs that you were just saying in your introduction that people really need to pay attention to have long-term, stable, and happy marriages. And it mirrors a lot some of the research that Dr. John Gottman found, and then that Sue Johnson has found in research where couples are learning to repair relationships after they've gotten distressed. And so we really want to be able to stay in communication, and that communication has more to do with our inner world and sharing in a connected space than it has to do with what we like and don't like and where we want to live and all the tasks that we kind of tend to get involved with.
Yeah, I tend to call that, I talk about that as sort of being the superficial level of the relationship. And I don't mean that it's not important, but it's not the deep stuff that actually connects us and provides us with the strong foundation to build a marriage on.
Exactly right. It's superficial in the sense that it's visible. We can see it easily. We can follow the conversation. We can track, I said this, you said that, you said you wanted this or that. But it's not the driver to the conversation. It's not the heart of what's going on in the relationship.
And I know that we were talking about this a little bit before we went on air. And one of the things that I run into, and I'm sure you run into it too, and you mentioned it about Dr. Houston's premarital counseling work and the idea that people don't see value in that. And I do know that if a couple is going to get married in a religious ceremony, they frequently have to do some kind of premarital work. But even that, my husband and I went through that, and it was basically, I think we sat down with the pastor, and he wasn't the one who was going to be marrying us because we were getting married in a different part of the country. And so he didn't know either one of us, and he basically talked to us for maybe 45 minutes. He goes, "Oh, you guys are good." I mean, and this is kind of what happens, and people go, "Well, we don't want to go to premarital counseling because they might tell us we shouldn't get married." And I'm thinking, well, if you even have that thought, that ought to be a warning sign right there. So what is it that they're finding in the premarital work, in these studies that they're doing, that Dr. Houston and Dr. Gottman and Sue Johnson are doing?
Well, one of the early warning signs is, and it seems kind of counterintuitive, like a turbulent courtship, lots of tears and high drama. I was talking to a young single, not so young actually, you know, early 30s, probably late 20s single gal the other day who was saying, "I just don't think I've found the right guy yet. When we get together, I don't have that. I may have a spark of attraction, but if we just don't click at a deep enough level, like I don't have that, I just want to bare my soul and we really connect deeply." And the research would say, actually, if you found that, that would be a warning sign on a first couple of dates. Because going deep too fast before you build trust and kind of security in the relationship is a sign that you're going to have more turbulence later. So what we see in the movies, like Love at First Sight and, you know, Sex on the First Date, and really going too deep too fast are often indicators of turbulence later and disconnection.
Yes, I read sometimes in, you know, I read advice columns and I read other people's blogs, and I was following this one person. I think her blog title was like Dater X or something, and it was her dating experiences, and it was suddenly after, you know, the second date, the guy's, you know, talking about marriage. I was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So that's the kind of thing you're talking about, right?
Exactly. That's right. Now, we know that some couples certainly are able to pull that off and make a secure and lasting relationship. But by and large, that high level of drama, getting kind of stuck in infatuation is not a great sign for long-term happy relationships.
Well, I actually have to confess that when I met my husband, I'd actually met him once 6 months before we actually got together. We lived in different parts of the country. And when we re-met each other and we spent a lot of time talking, I knew pretty early on that I thought he was probably a good match. Mm-hmm. But we spent every night on the telephone. I mean, this was back in the days, landlines, you know, hooked to the wall, long distance phone charges. I don't even want to tell you what our phone bills were for the first several months. You know, we spent a lot of time talking on the phone. We spent a lot of time writing letters. So it wasn't, a long period of time before we decided we were going to get married. But we did a lot of talking in that time period. Not just, you know, about the superficial things, but also about the deeper things that mattered. And I think that may be where the difference is.
Well, you're bringing up a really good point. I think that one of the things that helps, that we yearn for, is to really have this depth of emotional connection. We research all over the places pointing that as an important human need, and especially in our romantic relationships. And so when we can open up and share at a deeper level, it's a risk that we take. And taking those kinds of risks to share and to be heard and seen in pretty vulnerable ways, especially when that's reciprocated, really builds love.
You know, and so it's really kind of weird because right now, and I do not watch this. I have never watched this. I've caught very bits and pieces of shows like The Bachelor and Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And we have this, you know, age of reality TV where it's drama, 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 drama. And as you were talking about before, every romantic story that, you know, it's, okay, boy meets girl, something happens where that they have to overcome this highly dramatic thing, and then boy gets girl, and they live happily ever after, and nobody ever tells you how. So what people are experiencing right now as supposedly love is all of this unreality. Okay, you've got, I don't know how long The Bachelor lasts, what is it? 6 months, if it's even that long, 3 months, where suddenly this couple is going to decide that they love each other and they're going to marry each other, but basically all they've done is been on these weirdly arranged dates that most of us would never experience. So how do we get people past the idea that this is what it's supposed to be like?
Well, I wish we had the answer for that, really.
Oh, no, you're supposed to have the answer.
Well, I think we become more mindful and careful. I think one of the things is we're so hungry, emotionally hungry for contact, that when we go into new relationships, that, you go in kind of deprived, then it's easy to not use our good judgment, really, to just eat whatever's on the table, kind of, to follow the analogy. So one of the things that we really can do is make sure that we're fortified in many areas of our life and that we're not just relying on dating and trying to find one partner to be the end-all to make our lives happy. We really have to have good friends, good support, find employment that we appreciate and know ourselves in such a way that we're more fortified as we go into these relationships and we're not coming from such a desperate emotional places.
Well, and I can really relate to that because when I went to college, I look at my 19-year-old self and just shake my head and kind of go, oh, you poor dear. You were so sad. Because I really was love-starved. And I've said this before, that I'm so glad that neither one of my college boyfriends proposed to me because it would have been a disaster. Because I was so desperate. It's like, look at me, love me, want me. And, of course, it was awful. And luckily, after the breakup with the second one, I was able to do some self-analysis and awareness and kind of figure out, okay, what is it that you need? And then I got onto a much healthier track. But we don't really encourage, I should say society, people like you and I do, but society, we continue these romantic myths that there is, you know, your soulmate, there's this one person that when you find them, you know, the skies will open up, the sun will shine, the unicorns will fly, you'll never have another problem again. And when reality doesn't match that, then we think, oh, this one's not the right one.
Yes. Or we think, you know, something's the matter with me, so I should accept the one that's here.
Yes, there's that too. Right, the accepting of the bad behavior, which, I mean, I got a letter from somebody the other day who talks about how, you know, classic abuse kind of thing, emotional abuse, where, you know, he makes her feel like a princess but then belittles her at the same time. And I said, I think we need to change your definition of princess. But this is really what happens with people, is that they think that's all they deserve, or that the drama means love, that when we're fighting, you know, if we're fighting, then the makeup sex is great.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you
help
people?
And it is. It's just not sustainable.
Well, right. And yeah, I'm all for makeup sex. I think that's great. But a lot of times it's being misunderstood as that's healthy. And that's
yes.
What a good relationship is like.
Well, I think what happens really is when we are starved for love, and many of us are. We come out of home environments that maybe not that it's, you know, I don't want to blame parents. Parents are really trying to, many parents are doing really good and trying really hard. And, of course, others of us come from more neglectful or abusive environments. But when we are, we don't know ourselves well, we're kind of love deprived, that it's really easy then to cling on to anything that feels good relationally with another person, that we can then discount the things that are kind of danger indicators, or that it can't be lasting or fulfilling or isn't supportive to our growth as a being.
Well, and you said something really important that I find is absolutely critical, is that most of the time our parents are doing the best they can because they didn't get anything better or different. And frequently I'll have people in my office and I'll take them back through that, and they'll, and I'll say, well, of course you would do these behaviors. How could you not, based on where you came from? And they look at me like either I'm some absolutely fantastically brilliant person or like I have three heads, because it's never occurred to them that this is all multi-generational, that, mm-hmm. you know, that breaking that pattern is possible. But we have to recognize that there's a pattern to start with. And it's not, like you said, it's not about blaming the parents, because most of the time I think parents, although not all of them, but most of them I think have their heart in the right place. But how can you teach what you don't know and you don't have?
Mm-hmm. That's right. We can't give what we don't have, what we have not received, we can't give. So it's really an important thing to recognize those intergenerational patterns, not in a blaming way, but as a way to level our awareness and our consciousness around it. And fortunately, we do know now that the brain is very plastic, that we continue to learn and grow, that it's within our human heart to reach and expand and become more tomorrow than who we were today, and that we can continue to heal and repair, regardless of where we've come from or what kind of situation we came from.
This is Happily Ever After is Just the Beginning on webtalkradio.net. I'm Leslie Dorries, and I'm talking with couples therapist Dr. Becca Jorgensen about what symptoms spell trouble for your marriage and, more importantly, what you can do about them. And if you want more help with this, then I highly recommend that you just take a moment and either shoot me an email or give me a phone call and take advantage of, you know, create your Happily Ever After marriage brainstorming session with me. You can reach me at Leslie, L-E-S-L-I, at foundationscoachingnc.com. That's F-O-U-N-D-A-T-I-O-N-S, coachingnc.com, or at 919-924-0463. So I want to get back to where we just were in the conversation and talking about continuing to grow and continuing to change. And the whole research, when I first started, the brain's always fascinated me. And in the beginning, it's like, well, you were born with these neurons and nothing changes. And now all this exciting news about, the brain is actually really plastic and we can continue to learn things. So, Becca, what does a healthy relationship look like?
Well, when people feel really secure with each other, they bring up their complaints quickly to each other, are able to hear the other's concern pretty non-defensively, and they can stay in conversation around difficult things. When they get triggered, as we all do, they're able to come back and make repair. They see it as a relationship, a pattern within the relationship that each contributes to, and they're able to then not move into a blame game with each other. So there's a level of kind of warmth and stability, looking for the positive, and really making it safe for each other to share at kind of that deeper level.
And it's really important because people talk about wanting to have these deeply intimate relationships with each other, but they also don't want to get hurt. And it's like, okay, you can't have both. Now, we can make it safe or safer, but our partners aren't perfect. They're not mind readers. They're going to go kind of stumbling and bumbling their way through life, and occasionally they'll bump up against us. And like you said, we talk about the triggers and what gets us going. And it's that positive idea that they're not doing this on purpose. They just really don't have any idea. And if you, like you said, if we can be soft and gentle, but we're still going to get hurt. There's no way to love somebody and not open yourself up to being hurt.
Yeah, I like one of the things, one of the metaphors that Dr. Sue Johnson talks about is the relationship as a dance, and that our emotions are the music to the dance. And I like to add that it's really impossible to dance in close proximity and not step on each other's toes once in a while, because we're not perfectly attentive. We have different beats going on, and sometimes one of us isn't even feel like being on the floor for that dance. So it's important to know that we are, both partners are doing their best to be on the same team, and then we're in there to try to figure it out together how we can help support each other.
Well, and you said something a while back that I think is really important, and that's about bringing up the complaints.
Concerns quickly. Mm-hmm.
Concerns quickly. Yeah, I mean, and one of the things that I run into all the time is either, well, things are going so smoothly right now, I don't want to rock the boat, okay? Or two, they equate a concern with conflict, and they're conflict avoidant. So, I mean, and in a way, that turns into a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the longer I wait to bring it up, the bigger it gets, the more likely it's going to erupt into a conflict, as opposed to just in the beginning. It's like, you know, hey, you know, last Tuesday when we had that miscommunication, well, here's how I was feeling about that, and can we do it differently next time? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it doesn't necessarily have to be harsh or critical.
Well, actually, it doesn't work well at all when it's harsh and critical. So we do want to bring it up quickly, but we want to bring it up in a way that does, like your example was, that brings up it, something like, you know, I felt confused or concerned, or I'm sure you had a good reason for this or that happening. I'd like to talk about it. It kind of hurt my feelings. We bring it up in a way that doesn't forget that we're on the same team.
And I suppose that goes kind of back to the beginning of the relationship, when you talk about the warning signs about things being turbulent and lots of tears and drama, that if in the beginning you don't know how to bring up your concerns gently and lovingly, then you're just creating this pattern. It's sort of like dancing to head-bashing music, is my, to use your example of dancing. It's like, okay, I'm, you know, I don't want anybody yelling at me. I want the place that I work out, they play music. It's like, okay, can you please not have the music where somebody's screaming at me? Because that doesn't really help me.
Yeah. The one of the most common problems that we see in couple relationships is what we call, research refers to as, the pursue-withdraw pattern. So one mm-hmm. person brings something up in a highly charged way, and the other person has like no ability to respond other than with defense. And often that defense is to to avoid, to try to dismiss, to back up emotionally in some way. And that becomes a really common pattern of distress among couples, where it doesn't feel safe for either one. One person feels unheard because they bring up something, but they don't realize they're bringing it up in a way that makes it really hard for their partner to respond. And the other sweetheart is feeling kind of under the gun and pressured all the time. So they don't feel like they have the space to bring up their own complaints. This is one of the most common patterns that we see, that really just kind of slowing down, remembering we're on the same team, bringing things up gently, giving the other the benefit of the doubt, even when our feelings are hurt, really helps relationships to be on steady ground.
So that's an interesting point, because I know that right now in our world, in addition to being attached to these ridiculous reality shows, we're also attached to this concept of busy, that somehow busy is great. And people, I don't think, are taking the time to slow down. I actually had somebody say to me years ago, you know, my marriage is important, but, and I said, now you're going to tell me why that statement isn't true, because he was, but I have to go to work, and I have to do this, and I have to do that. And are people really allowing themselves to step back, slow down, take time with each other?
Well, it's a big problem in relationships. We do that during courtship.
Mm-hmm.
When we're high in infatuation, we move mountains to be with each other. You were describing writing, you know, writing letters, and we'll spend all kinds of time in conversation, dating, writing, and then it's like, okay, we did that. Let's get on to the next thing.
And yeah, let's stop that, right?
Yeah, we really need to continue to take time to really stay. We're evolving all the time, and we need to be checking in with each other and taking time to let each other in on what new we're learning, what new we're feeling, and really staying connected. And that it does take time, and not just time. It's not the same as let's just go out to dinner or go shopping or do this home project together. It's actually taking time to have eye-to-eye, face-to-face, heart-to-heart sharing.
Right. I talk about most couples communicate in what I call informational 5-minute bursts. You know, that if you're actually continuing to talk to somebody after 10, 15, 20 minutes, you're going deeper into the conversation. You're not just, how was your day, but, oh, so tell me more about how you felt in that meeting when your boss said X. You know, now we're down into it, but nobody seems to want to spend that amount of time, and then they wonder, because you actually talk about this in your article about, you know, declined affection in the first 2 years, or lack of sex, or, you know, these places where we actually will reconnect with our partners, and somehow people aren't making the connection to just what you were saying, the amount of time that we spent when we were courting. We don't even spend, gosh, probably not even 25%.
Yeah, and we don't need to actually have mountains of that kind of intensity, but we do need to have it on a regular basis and probably on a daily basis. Gottman's research of happy couples describes, you know, 20 to 30 minutes a day where they're in conversation. And we know from some of the neuro research now that having a good heart-to-heart conversation releases oxytocin, which is the bonding chemical. It's the same chemical that happens when we have orgasm or sex. And it's just as sexy and attaching to have those heart-to-heart conversations, and we need them on a regular basis.
So in addition to having these regular conversations, and in addition to being able to bring up concerns quickly and lovingly, what are some other specific steps that either a person on their own or a couple together can take to really create the kind of marriage they want?
We can be so aware of our own signals. We can become better at recognizing the signals that we're sending, so we send clear signals. Because when we're distressed or upset, we say things we don't really mean. We mean it in the heat, but we don't really mean them. we send distorted signals that then our partners have a really hard time responding to. So we can, slowing down, I think, is really an important thing, that we can pay attention to the signal we're sending and how it's being received on the other side, so that we are kind and warm, that we look for the positive things, that we, I think, an attitude of gratitude and having a practice of gratitude together and individually on a daily basis is really important for the relationship and for our own hearts, the health of our own hearts, so that we can make it easier for ourselves and our sweethearts to have this loving understanding and kindness. So I think another thing we can really practice is empathy. We know that empathy is different than sympathy, and that empathy can be learned, so that we practice putting ourselves in our partner's shoes so that we can have compassion and remember where they're coming from.
And that's so important, because one of the things that I don't allow in working with my clients, and I try to get them not to allow with each other, but it takes a little while, is to never tell somebody what they're thinking or they're feeling. I find that incredibly disrespectful. And you're generally not going to get a good response. Plus, the other kind of the corollary is when somebody tells you that they feel a certain way, you tell them, no, you don't. Because I don't want you to feel that way. I don't want you to feel hurt, therefore you don't feel hurt, or you're too sensitive, or all those other things, which I think
goes to your point. Oh, we just deny them their feelings, don't feel that way. I don't want you to feel that way, instead of really accepting what they are feeling.
And that comes, I think, back to your point about the importance of empathy and kind of stepping in to the other person's position. Even though I get that I don't feel this way, but I can certainly understand and support that you do. I can't remember, something my husband did, or I did to my husband a few months ago. I probably put my cold hands on him or something. And he said, if I did that to you, that would make you crazy. And I said, yes, I agree, it would. But it doesn't bother you. So, and it's that kind of understanding where, yes, we're different people, and this behavior, if you did it to me, bothers me, but it doesn't, the reverse isn't true, so it's okay. He's like, really?
Right.
And then he stopped and said, yeah, you're probably right. It's like, it was like, yes, honey, I do recognize that if you did this to me, I wouldn't be okay. And
I really appreciate you letting me do it to you.
Right, exactly. Exactly. We've had this whole thing about my cold extremities all our lives. So, so I think what I'm hearing you say is that, again, taking ownership of our own stuff and remembering that we actually love this person. We chose to be with this person. And if we can keep that in the forefront, that would be really helpful.
That's so helpful when we remember it. Lots of times we marry what we aspire to have more of. So I'm thinking of my husband. He's just this wonderful, calm presence. I'm kind of a go, 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 and he's this wonderful, calm presence. Now, when I'm on go and he's on slow, I can get out of sorts. I've not got to remember. It's actually what attracted him to me was that he has this kind, soft, patient way. And I need that in my life, and I need to develop that inside of myself as well. So really remembering, lots of times the qualities that we're drawn to are the ones that drive us nuts later. And remembering that those really are the part of the reason why we fell in love, why we chose love with the person that we are with.
Well, Becca, we could continue this conversation, but I want to let people know where they can find out more information about you and about how they can bring more openness and closeness and love into their relationship.
Great. Well, I have a gift for your listeners, 11 love tips that they can get by texting the number 33444 and the word Leslie D, L-E-S-L-I-D, to 33444. Get some love tips, and they can also find me at my website, Dr. Rebecca Jorgensen, or livinginlove.us.
Great. So, as I've said before, great marriages are boring to watch, but not to live. And if you think about the marriages that you admire, my guess is that what you see is calm, loving, and supportive partners, not yelling in tears. And if you want to have that kind of marriage, what can you do to make it that way? And basically, you've gotten some great information today, and I hope you'll start using it. And keep listening for more. And until next time, stay loving.